From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we caught up with Peter Laval, the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk, and had a free-ranging conversation about life in Russia, perceptions of Americans about Russia, Donald Trump's presidency, and a lot more. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow on Friday. Peter, a pleasure. I guess we're back to talking over the internet as opposed to face-to-face. It was certainly my pleasure to visit you at your studio, and I appreciate your graciousness.
We're always thrilled to have visitors.
Yeah, it was nice. So, wow, I mean, all the stuff that's going on right now. You got on-again, off-again, Summit 2. You've got... we'll start wherever you like, because we have so many things to talk about.
Well, I have to say that I was not pleased with the process, not necessarily the outcome, but the process of the Helsinki summit. I think that Trump committed a self-inflicted wound, and I think he just went in the wrong direction. And of course, he created an opening for the media, and the media had a heyday. What was it, the three or four news cycles? They just went completely nuts. At the same time, the good outcome for that is that we have people like Brennan and Comey using their ability to still have access to secret information. Well, it looks like that's going to be decapitated, which is really good news. So they abused it. Yep. And so their security clearance is going to go out the window. Yep. Is it all? It should. These people are hostile to the current administration. They're hostile to the current president. And they're going to use their security clearance to thwart the executive officer of the United States, Donald Trump. Now, you like him or dislike him, it's his job right now. He's in the driver's seat. We shouldn't have people like that sniping at him and monetizing it.
They're trading it.
Hi. So, you know, I think it's time for that to be resolved. The second summit has been postponed until next year. I think this is extremely good. I believe that you should, in this case, like meeting with Kim, it's like a huge icebreaker. That's good. Okay.
Right.
Meeting Putin, I guess that's an icebreaker as well. But when you take another bite at the apple, you better have something to show for it. And I think these two need to have something to show. You have to remember that with the midterms and Trump's going to go start storming the country, he's going to pull that envelope that he carries around in his pocket, and he has all his campaign promises, and he's just going to say, check, I met Putin. Right. I kept my promise, ladies and gentlemen, vote GOP.
Right.
So many people don't understand that, because it's not America first, it's Trump first. And once you start understanding it's Trump first, then you understand him so much better. Okay, you still may disagree with him, but it makes more sense. So I think it's a good idea that it be delayed until next year. We're coming to the end of the New START agreement. They need to be working on that at the very, very least, because nuclear proliferation is a very important issue, and the United States and Russia have to lead. So I think that's good news. And the reason why it was called not going to be held is that the Russian side didn't want to go.
Yeah.
Putin doesn't want to go to Washington because they, as they say in Russian, zachem, why?
You know, you saw what happened there. One of the things that was most interesting, Putin cuts to the quick with, look, you guys, well, relations are not normal between our countries, and so there's not a normal process for extradition. You've got these people that you say committed crimes in your country that you know you're never going to try, and you can say what you want about them. But we do have an agreement from the late 1990s whereby you could come over here. You can't carry them away, but you can come over here and interview these people and do some fact-finding, and then if you find a basis for alleging some kind of crime, perhaps we can then talk about what process to follow. But if we do that, there's a couple of people we would like to talk with that have done some things here, like one guy that carried off a few billion of our dollars and never paid a tax on it to either of us. And he'd like to have
speaking
a conversation.
Of William Browder.
Yeah, Bill Browder is one, and you know, and then there was another and another. And so what happened immediately, you know, Trump said, gee, this is a good idea. It's a good place to, you know, maybe start having a conversation. Immediately, Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, produces a resolution saying no Russians that are going to interview any Americans, whether it's ambassadors like McFaul or anybody else, period. That's the end of that resolution. 98-0 in the Senate. They didn't even give themselves a pay raise by those numbers.
But there was a reason for that. That was essentially the Russian side trolling the American political establishment. It was taking a poke
and they did well.
American exceptionalism. Yep. Because they knew it. I mean,
of course.
There's a certain level of equivalence. Oh my God.
Right, exactly.
Shivers down your spine. No, it was trolling. They knew they were never going to do that. It just shows the patent hypocrisy. Yep. Of it all. And in a way, it's just like, this is one of the reasons why we don't get along, because the U.S. bullies, bribes, and uses violence in bilateral and multilateral relationships. And the Russian side is saying, you're not going to do it with us.
Right.
So that was what Putin was making a pitch to his base.
Right.
All right. So many people misunderstood. When I heard that, I just had a really good chuckle because that moment, and then everyone's hair is on fire on one side of the, you remember the presser. There was the Russian side separated by a walkway, and then the American side. And the American side is boiled. I was laughing my head off, okay?
Yeah, they were.
Because I knew that was a trigger. See, this shows you, I keep explaining to people, the Russian side has very limited resources, and they have to be smart in how they use those resources. The U.S., because it can print dollars endlessly, is amazingly sloppy all of the time, and it can take losses, and they make up for it. The Russians cannot take losses. They cannot take strategic losses. So what did it cost the Russian side to bring up this 1999 treaty? Zip!
Nothing.
Okay, but what did it do to the American side? Oh my goodness, right. I thought it was brilliant.
Yep, well, and also, just for people who were unaware of this, which is most of the world, A, it points out that there's no extradition between the two countries, and so whatever you plan to do with these Russian spies, quote-unquote, there's no legal process, and that's your fault because you wouldn't let us create one. And also, it demonstrated exactly what situation Trump is in as he tries to make nice with Russia or anyone else. He's got Congress attacking him from the right almost, well, I would say unanimously.
Yeah, it's the establishment that's attacking him. It's bipartisan establishment thinking about the status quo. The amazing thing, Don, I've lamented this so much, and I'm sure you have too, that ever since the end of the Cold War, we could actually even go to the imperial presidency of Richard Nixon in a way, if you think about the illegal bombing of Cambodia, is that, you know, the Congress has abrogated its foreign policy responsibilities to the executive. And now, over the last 16 months, it's completely reversed. They're doing everything they can to cripple this president's foreign policy initiatives. It's an amazing a shift that what we've seen over the last 25, 30 years.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's you have, you know, I've mentioned this a few times, that what I saw at the two conventions was an example of this almost on steroids, where at the Republican convention, you have the candidate saying, you know, no more regime change, no more stupid wars, let's make nice with Russia and China, getting a standing ovation. And at the Democratic convention, you got an endless stream of generals, you know, saying, let's get tough with Russia, and having half of the people assembled there, standing up out of their chairs in a war fever.
Yeah, well, you and I will just betray our age when I say this, is that during the Cold War, the Democrats never had anything bad to say about the Soviet Union. But now the Democrats have nothing good to say about Russia.
That's
amazing
right.
Turnaround.
Yep, absolutely right. Yep. Yeah, it's amazing. So let's see. What else we got? We got that summit thing is you know, off the table, at least apparently, until next year.
The thing is, too, is that the Russian side understands how American politics work. Maybe they even meddled in it. We don't know. But you wouldn't know that from watching the mainstream media. But it essentially the midterms, because what I've said repeatedly, and the optics of Helsinki reinforce my thinking, is that even if Trump wants to make an agreement, can he? I mean, right. Is he in a politically strong enough position to take an initiative, move the needle on an initiative? We don't really know, but we'll know after the midterms.
Right.
We'll know. And, you know, if there is a if the status quo essentially remains and the GOP is in control of both houses, then I think that the Russians will say, well, I think we can make a deal with him. But if Trump takes a huge loss or even a meaningful loss, which is normal for a first term of a president's first midterm.
Right.
So, the generic vote, you can interpret what it means. I mean, I've looked at the numbers. You can go either way. So I think the Russian side are saying, well, we'll see what the midterms have to say, then we can decide how we want to move forward, with the exception of arms control. I keep stressing that on Crosstalk. It was so important. People were so aware of it in our generation. When we were young men.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's not talked enough about. It's very important to do. Now, if the Soviet Union and the United States can sign an arms control agreement, Russia up today and Trump's America certainly can.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead, what we have is, and this was a bipartisan project, you had Obama proposing and then Trump signing on to a $1 trillion upgrade of nuclear weapons on this side. And then, of course, a response from Russia saying, well, we're not going to spend $1 trillion like you crazy fools, but we got some new toys and here's what some of them look like.
Yeah, but again, I stressed this over and over again the last few months. Russia has limited resources. What is it spending? Okay, first of all, this fiscal year, Russia cut defense spending because it's spending more money on social issues and infrastructure. Right. You saw Moscow. They spent a lot of money on infrastructure for the World Cup.
What a beautiful city. But amazing.
Russia's spending money on defensive, to defend itself.
Right.
The Americans are building an entire new generation of offensive weapons.
Yep.
Okay? And are they building that because they feel insecure? They don't feel safe? No, because it's a good business for some people.
That's right.
You see, the American arms industry is for profit.
That's right.
The Russian arms industry is primarily for defense, though, yes, of course, it does sell its weapons abroad. Right. But the priorities are very clear. Defense first, then sell. For the Americans, it's, everything points to the bottom line of these fabulously rich and profitable arms companies.
Trump, as much as admitted this at the press conference after the meeting with Putin, that hey, a big part of our economic revival is that we're selling weapons at a record pace, and the reason for that, it's not even subtext, is we don't make much else anymore.
What's made isn't in demand. Okay,
right. Well,
that's the problem. And you coerce your allies to buy more.
Right, captive market.
Gareth Porter, I know the original place where he published it, but it's on antiwar.com right now. And he has a super excellent, as he always does. I mean, he's shifting his expertise from Iran to North Korea now. And just how Trump's own administration, individuals within the administration, are trying to trip up his North Korean initiative. Right. And these leaks that go to particularly NBC, and everybody knows NBC wants to hear the worst they possibly can about Donald Trump, and just derailing, sabotaging him, all in the name of the arms producers. Because if there's peace on the Korean Peninsula, then why are, 30,000 American troops doing there?
Right. I mean, yeah, you can look around the globe and ask the same question because you have that going on. The response from Trump is also interesting. When I saw the tweet the other day, where Trump, all caps, you know, saying, "Hey, Ron, if you say bad stuff, we're going to blow you into oblivion." That, with, you know, whatever the tweet was, that where it looked like he was off the hook. When I read that in first thing that morning, I thought to myself, "Oh wow, it sounds like he's close to a deal with Iran." Because that's what he did with North Korea right before he cut the deal with Kim. It's like he's playing to the audience.
I think
here.
This has everything to do with the midterms.
Yep.
Again, right. that mythical envelope in his pocket. Because he's going to say, yeah. "Well, I was at the United Nations General Assembly, and I stuck it to the Iranians, and then I had John Bolton get this big committee together, and we said, you know, never threaten us." And he's going to that's his campaign fodder.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, and if someone explained to me once, a dyed-in-the-wool Trump supporter, he said to me, "Him someone crosstalk." He said, "He's just placating the Israelis and the Saudis." Because he doesn't need those lobbies against him as well.
Right.
So he's basically, you know, we're going to try to get out of Syria, irrespective of what the military and the deep state want. He wants still to get out. And, you know, and let the Israelis and the Saudis, which, you know, in principle, I'm really against that. But I can understand the logic of this argument.
Right.
Is that he'll take care of it later and just come out with some very boisterous, bellicose words about Iran might be enough for him to get to the midterms, okay? Because I just don't see, you know, the talk is now that it came from Australian intelligence. I didn't know they had much intelligence down there. No offense, Australia. You know, that Trump is thinking about some kind of military strike. I think just leaking that and saying it, that is the policy itself. That's all they want to achieve, is to present a bellicose position, not necessarily go through with it. But you never know.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to that. Let's see, some of the other things that you've covered on Crosstalk over the last, I guess the most recent program, Socialist Dystopia, and you're talking essentially about the same conversation that they're having here in the United States, is the Democratic Party going to get tugged leftward as it attempts to respond to 2016 and to the situation it faces now? And if that happens, is that a good or bad thing in terms of their being electable?
Well, what my mantra is about all this, you know, I mean, we've known each other for a while now, is it?
Yeah.
I would like to see the Democratic Party go back to its roots a little bit more. Like, care about people, you know, like,
right.
The middle class, you know, that this identity politics is so destructive, you know, and I'm really tired of, you know, the Latino bloc and the white male bloc and the Cuban bloc and, you know, the Jewish bloc. We're all Americans, and right. I want it to be based on values.
Right.
Values.
And the bulk of those blocs are actually working class people, and that never enters into the conversation.
And I think that's what you have to work. It's basically, you know, looking after the middle class working people. That's what I think it should be. Black, white, Cuban, Latino, whatever.
Right.
I don't think in those terms. My goodness, that's what I was taught. I was taught not to think in those terms.
Right.
And I'm glad I was, because I look at values. This postmodernist identity politics is, I can't think and I won't think that way, because I think it's inherently destructive and it is inherently divisive.
Right.
You know, I made a program a few weeks ago, you know, no party for white men. I mean, even the rhetoric that comes on, you know, this, you know, working for equity, for absolute equality, that's totalitarianism. You can't go there. You have equal opportunity for everyone, but you can't have absolute outcomes. You cannot engineer outcomes, because the only way you can do that is coercion, and that is at the heart of a totalitarian project.
Right.
So let's not say that. Equal opportunity, yes. But say we have to have 50% this and 20% that, 30%. No, that's social engineering. You know, it's basically saying that my characteristics as a person. Okay, let's describe Peter Lavelle right now. Late middle age, white male, Catholic, born in the middle of America. For some people, that's a category. But That doesn't tell you who I am.
It doesn't tell you anything
about me. Talk to me.
Right. That's right.
You haven't asked me.
Right.
You've just put a stamp on my forehead.
Yep.
I thought Jim Crow came to an end. This is new Jim Crow.
Well, you had in opposition.
How dare people say they know me?
The people that buried Jim Crow, among them the most prominent, Martin Luther King, said, "I have a dream my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." And
and
his opposition to war are at the core of why he was murdered. That idea is something that the elites do not want to see flourish, because now you talk about unity among the masses of people as opposed to division, which means that they start looking at, gee, how come none of us have money, just that guy, and start planning to do something about it?
Yeah, and what it does is that, I mean, of course, I talk to my GOP friends and conservatives, and they're just, they're rubbing their hands together. This is going to be a great, they'll watch the Democrats crush themselves. And I always say, slow down. Mm. Be careful what you wish for. I would like to see a healthy Democratic Party. Okay, that's coming from a conservative. I want to have a robust a debating partner. Okay, I like to get into it. Okay, let's get into the policy. What's going right now? It's fractionalizing the Democratic Party, and that is not good for the GOP in the long term.
Yeah, there's
it's not.
Everything has been completely personalized, and politics is supposed to be the area in which public policy is decided, the mechanism, the methodology by which public policy is decided. That begins with an analysis of one's present condition and a study of public policy options, an honest discussion of them, and then some sort of process where people's interests are honestly represented and can find expression in actualizing a decision on a public policy and actualizing the policy. That's what's supposed to happen.
But it's not happening.
At the beginning.
I see these clans, and particularly the rump clan known as the Clintons. Mm. They're not about policy. They're about power.
That's right.
That's what they want. And that's why they demonize people. That's why they buy into these ridiculous conspiracy theories, because there is no discussion about policy. It's about power. But you know what? This whole strategy didn't come about with the advent of Donald Trump. Go back to 2010.
Right.
This strategy has been in place since 2010. And what has happened to Democrats all across the nation? They have lost. They've lost and lost. Mm. They sure had, absolutely, they had Barack Obama for two terms, but he was a failed president, okay? He was an absolute failure as a president, and he had no coattails.
Yep. And they had the Congress from 2006, and they lost it in 2010, in essence.
What they need to do is they need to have an exorcism. They have to get these Clintonites out. And the Democratic Party has to take a long, sober look at itself in the mirror. Is it going to be the voters, or is it going to be the donors again?
Yeah, that's right.
If they choose the donors, it's not going to work.
Well, that's the problem with both parties.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, we should have this. I always say this on Cross that we need to have a separate program on the GOP, because I'm not a Republican. Okay. I don't have anything to do with the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, anyone that has someone like John McCain in it, I don't want to be in a party like that. No way. Okay. John Bolton, all these people, and I have nothing in common with these people. I see them as ideological foes.
I'll go back again to this unanimous vote last week in the Senate, 98-0. That means every member of both parties. And what happens in that situation, if you look to it, you can say, well, maybe it's because it's such a popular opinion that they felt compelled to do it. No. They had a poll last week. What do Americans think about Russiagate? Answer, they don't. It's down in the below 1% of the people think it's an important issue column. It's below everything else, like my job, my house, my food, my shelter, my kids, all of that stuff.
Yeah, but passing that, it's a non-binding resolution that they voted for that was at no cost to anyone.
Right, but
Big
they did it right away.
Deal. big deal.
But I'm saying they did it right away because they felt compelled for some reason to do it. But the thing that compelled them was not political necessity, because the people watching, if anybody even noticed it, don't care about that.
Yeah, but the thing is that, again, this is the dangerous time that we live in, is because we have the vast majority of the citizenry that are completely disconnected with the elites.
Right.
And the elites are arguing among themselves, right, mostly on MSNBC and CNN.
Right.
It's a tiny, they have a little microscopic world. Unfortunately, they have a lot of power and a lot of money, but yep, it's completely disjointed. I mean, you know, if I could just say real quickly,
yeah,
I met so many people, primarily from the UK, during the World Cup here in Moscow. Mm. And I just did the same thing over and over again. So what's, you know, I would just say, you know, what is the biggest surprise for you? And the fury that came from these people, said they lied to us about everything. This is a really great place.
Yep.
People are nice.
Yep.
Everything's in English for us.
Yep.
There are buses everywhere. There's shuttles everywhere.
Yep.
There are these stands. Everyone give you help. I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing carnival of humanity. And they kept saying over and over again, they lied to us. They lied. They said that, yep, word. They lied to us.
Yep. I was trying to explain to a young Russian woman yesterday who does some media work over there in Moscow, because she was born in 1996, I think she said, what it was like when we were growing up. So if someone asked you to describe Moscow from the media here, first of all, it's in black and white, okay? It's monochromatic. It's not in color. Secondly, it's always gloomy and dark. There's some really deep, ugly, scary music going on in the background. There are gloomy-looking people standing on long lines, wearing shabby clothes, waiting to be handed packages of shoddy goods. And that was basically Moscow. And when I went there in 1990, even, when they were having the severe economic problems, it didn't look like that at all. And when I went back this time, it was like I wanted to hear that music when they arrive at Oz in The Wizard of Oz. That's what it's, because it was like arriving at the Emerald City or something. It's gorgeous. And the difference, when I went to the Arbat, to Arbat Street in 1990, you know, you had artists and, you know, food vendors and stuff, you know, peddling things and everything. And now, it's, I don't know how long it is, but I walked at least a mile and a half of rows of restaurants and stores. And oh my God, the city is thriving. And that, you don't get that picture from the media here at all. They have you thinking that the people are starving to death because of sanctions.
Yeah, I mean, you even had over at The Guardian, you know, they were grudgingly saying, well, it's not so bad. But as soon as it was over, they said, it was still a sham. You know, all the political prisoners were taken to Siberia. You didn't see. I'm going on. And we just,
oh,
I bring it into the office and I read it aloud. And everyone's just laughing their heads off. And said, where do they get this stuff? Okay.
I know.
I remember there was a course. I don't want to go personal here, but I remember the New York Times correspondent here a few years ago. And she wrote an article, and I wrote to her about the article. I said, well, why do you always use the same three families? I mean, they're like your props all the
right.
time.
Yeah, yeah.
As my friend Ludmila told me, it's like,
brother.
I mean, Ludmila, okay, I'm sure Ludmila isn't happy. And who's happy? What group of people? And there's always a group of people in society that are not happy, but you always go back to the same person, your friend Ludmila. You know, I don't know why you do that. And it's so patently out of context. I mean, it's like Masha Gessen being a spokesperson for the Russian public.
I know.
I mean, she's a Russian Jew, lesbian, believes in polygamy, hates Putin, never has a logical thought about Russia. And you know what? That's her lifestyle, and that's her opinion. That's just fine with me. But don't look to her as, you know, the embodiment
the voice of Russia,
of the Russian body politic, because she's really like an amazingly marginalized person.
Well, we're out of time here, because I would recommend if we had a little more time to discuss, perhaps the person that should embody in the public mind the Russian people was that guy who's nailed his testicles to the ground at Red Square on a couple of occasions. But Peter, thank you for your time.
Yeah.
And we'll be looking forward to the next episodes of Crosstalk on RT. Thank you for your time.
All right. Sounds great.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.